Good evening, and welcome to the July 2024 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, the summer months are here, and it's a great time to pick up a new book and maybe learn something new. Maybe even something about one of my favorite topics, LGBTQ+ history. My guest tonight is a leading author on local LGBTQ+ history and has written several books, with his newest being LGBTQ+ Trailblazers of San Francisco. And the stories and people extend well beyond San Francisco, including to places right here in Sonoma County, like Guerneville. Dr. William Lipsky is with us tonight to talk about some of California's early gay history, so stay with us. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, July 28th, 2024. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of July 28, 2024. A Catholic group operating in Michigan is sued to block the state's ban on conversion therapy for minors. According to the Detroit Free Press, attorneys with the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty filed the suit on behalf of three organizations, including Catholic Charities, Hillsdale County's, and Lansing-based therapist Emily McJones. Michigan joins 21 other U.S. states that have banned the pseudoscientific form of psychological torture. The suit argues that Michigan's House Bill 4616 violates the plaintiff's rights to free speech and free exercise of religion, despite the fact that the law does not apply to religious institutions. According to the Detroit Free Press, quote, because plaintiffs are chilled and prohibited from discussing issues of human sexuality and gender identity, their clients are denied access to ideas they wish to hear and to counseling that would help them live consistently with their own personal, religious, and life goals. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed the bill into law last July, and the bill bans licensed health professionals in the state from practicing so-called conversion therapy on minors. Providers who violate the law can face discipline from state licensing boards, including revocation of their professional licenses. Conversion therapy is now widely considered to be a form of psychological torture. The practice has been debunked as harmful and pseudoscientific by the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Medical Association, as well as many other professional healthcare associations. According to Equality Michigan Executive Director Irwin Knott, 15% of Michigan's LGBTQ+ youth have reported being threatened or subjected to conversion therapy. And last week, we reported on a new law here in California that bans public schools from outing transgender kids to their parents. And shortly after the bill was signed into law, Chino Valley Unified School District and some parents have filed a lawsuit against the state of California over this new law. Governor Gavin Newsom signed Assembly Bill 1955 into law a week before last. It bars school districts from requiring teachers or other staff to disclose a student's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression to their parents or guardians without the student's consent. Such forced outings put youth at risk if their families are not accepting. The new law takes effect this coming January and will be the first of its kind in the nation. The district and parents are represented by Liberty Justice Center, which is based in Texas. The suit filed in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of California argues that the new law violates the First and 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, as well as the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, a federal law. The Chino Valley School District has had some other legal clashes with the state. California Attorney General Bob Bonta sued the district last year after it adopted a policy forcing the outing of transgender, non-binary, or other non-gender, non-conforming students to their parents or guardians. A judge temporarily blocked the policy, and the district then amended it to require parents or guardians to be notified only if a student requests any changes to their official records. And voters in the small Alameda city of Sunol have successfully recalled two school board members who sparked broad outrage with their decision to ban flying the pride flag on school grounds. It marks the fourth successful push this year to oust elected school board officials who promoted anti-LGBTQ policies. After the final results of the July 2nd recall were posted on July 17th, Sunol Glen Unified School District Board President Ryan Jurgensen was recalled by 52% of the 532 people who cast ballots. Fellow board member Linda Hurley was also recalled by 51.5% of voters. The two vacant positions will now fall to Alameda County Board of Education President Genevette Cole to fill. Gay Alameda Unified School District board member Ryan Lalonde told the Bay Area Reporter that he wasn't surprised by the outcome of the Sanol recall election. He credited success to the fact that community members and students in the district had led the effort. And finally, here locally, registration is now underway at Napa Valley College for the Introduction to LGBT Studies class. It'll meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 11 a.m. starting on Tuesday, August 27th. This course is part of the LGBT Studies degree program, and there are no prerequisites or requirements to enroll. There's also no textbook required. You can learn more and register right now at napavalley.edu. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. My guest tonight is a longtime friend who I first met at the GLBT Historical Society's Museum in San Francisco's Castro neighborhood. Dr. William Lipsky got his doctorate in history from Carnegie Mellon University. He's been a visiting professor at Pepperdine University in Los Angeles and UCLA. He's also worked extensively in private industry, specializing in employee and management skill development. Dr. Lipsky has authored several books, including Gay and Lesbian San Francisco, and now his latest titled LGBTQ+ Trailblazers of San Francisco. Bill, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. We've known each other for, going on many years now, I would say.
It's great
to finally have you on to share your story and to talk about all your work with our listeners. But before we get to the books, and this latest book that you've written, give us a sense of where you grew up and some of the LGBT history that you witnessed in your lifetime.
Well, I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I grew up during the age of McCarthy and the Lavender Scare, although I was a little bit too young to remember all of that. If it was going on when I was there, but it was a period of very great conservatism and conformity, and we didn't know any different. But you know, growing up, you want to fit in with, you know, your family and your friends, and get your identity and your sense of self from family and friends. So I was sort of going along with what was happening. And when I began to discover about myself and wanted to find out more about myself, I discovered that there was nothing to find out. There were no sources to go to. Not only could I not find out anything about LGBT history, there was no LGBT history.
Mm-hmm.
There was no books, no history, no biographies, or any materials that had any reference to LGBT people at all, to what was going on. And as I got a little bit older, I found that I could get some information by looking at general histories, by going through the index and looking up homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And some books might mention, for example, that Alexander the Great was homosexual, or Leonardo da Vinci was homosexual, or this person's poetry had an influence in it, or could be read in a particular way. So I was at least able to discover that in the past, there were some people with whom I could identify. To say, well, I'm not the only person, because I wasn't going to take a survey of my, classmates in the eighth grade to find out who else there was, and gradually got some information about some people in the past, which I certainly was not the first one to do. There have been lists being made forever.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school, I found a book which is still, I think, important and actually still in print, called City of Night. Hmm. And by John Retchie, who talked about his travels around the United States and some of the different cities that he was in. And he disguises some of the places, but the places that where things took place, you know, like a gay neighborhood in Los Angeles or the gay beach at Santa Monica. I recognized those places and started going to them because I was already in high school. I was driving and I was able to meet some other people.
Mm-hmm.
And meeting other people, then of course met other people and was able to find out that there were more of me in the world. And it was, you know, helpful. It was reassuring to know I wasn't the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And also to discover that I didn't have a problem or a condition, because at this time, we're talking about the 60s, being gay was considered to be a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And went through, you know, the problem of, well, if I have this wrong with me, what else do I have wrong with me? And if I'm meeting somebody that has this mental illness, what other mental illnesses might they have? And is there some danger involved in meeting these people? And it took a while, and I realized, no, these people are like I am. And of course, talking with other people, you discovered that they had the same feelings, and the feelings were normal for them. The feelings were normal for me. They were natural. This was not a mental illness or a mental condition.
Mm-hmm. Do you think then that experience sort of what inspired you then to begin to research and write about history?
I think it was, because I did have an interest in who I was, who I am, and we are products of our environment, and our environment is the product of what went before. The present is the creation or the evolution, however you want to put it, of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how is it that these things happen? Who else was around? What were their experiences? I can only experience, as far as I know, this particular time and place. And there were people that experienced other times and other places. They were not us without cell phones or televisions or cars. They saw the world differently. The world was different for them.
Right. Right. You know? Well, this latest book is called LGBTQ Trailblazers of San Francisco, but this was not your first. You've written several books before this. Talk about some of the other projects that you've written and maybe your favorite.
I did write, the previous book I did was Gay and Lesbian San Francisco, which was an overview history of San Francisco from the Gold Rush to the present, to what was the present when I wrote the book. It's been a while. I probably should be updated. And that to me was fascinating, because a lot of the early history was pretty much unexplored, especially at that time. We were just taking a look into that, and it's a very rich history. One of the difficulties is that people then came out of a climate of opinion and thoughts where you didn't talk about sexuality at all.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly you didn't talk about different sexual orientations. They didn't have the concept, but people getting with each other, you know, men getting with men rather than only men getting with women, or women getting with women, or some of the other, you know, possibilities, and some of the different things you could do. So there was not very much available. And since terminologies were different, it was difficult to, again, go back and do the index. But there are some some mansions. There are some things from the earlier days, but it's fascinating that we go all the way back at least to the Gold Rush and probably before. Some of the other things I did, I started off writing books about the World Fairs that were held in San Francisco. San Francisco has actually had three World Fairs. Again, this are things that people aren't necessarily aware of. The first one was the Midwinter Fair, which was in 1894. It was in Golden Gate Park. It was the fair for which the first Fine Arts Museum was built. We are now on the third iteration of that, and for which the Japanese Tea Garden was built, and that survived. The first art museum was damaged in an earthquake in 1919. Hmm. And most people are not aware of that. And, you know, there's a huge, rich history to Golden Gate Park. Then I did a book, a neighborhood history book, which was about the Marina District. And I liked that one very much because I had never done anything about a neighborhood, about a development of a neighborhood. And it really, the development of the neighborhood really, was like an example of what went on in San Francisco from the Gold Rush and is still going on, is how you developed communities, landfill and grading and creating neighborhoods and places for people. And since the Marina District had actually been the site of the second World's Fair, which was the Panama Pacific Exposition, for which we got the Palace of Fine Arts. I did a book about the second exposition. That was the next one, and then I did the gay and lesbian one.
Wow, you've been busy.
Yeah, well, this took a while,
Well,
it took 10, 15 years, yeah.
When I talk to my students about, one of the things I ask them is, how do you think San Francisco became such a large gay community? And oftentimes they'll point to, the hippie invasion of the 60s. But this started a long, long time ago. You've alluded to the Gold Rush. And one of the things that I love about the new book, LGBTQ plus Trailblazers of San Francisco, is that you talk about the very early formation of a gay community in San Francisco. And it was way before the 60s.
It was way before the 1960s. It was way before the 1860s. We have always been here. We have been here at least since the Gold Rush and probably before. The Native Americans, who believed everything in nature was correct, that if it existed in nature, it was, part of the nature and part of the natural world, were accepting of what we now call two-spirit people. We don't know, or haven't come across anything about them in the communities, the Native American communities in the Bay Area. But I do know that with the Gold Rush in 1848-49, with the Argonauts, the 49ers, San Francisco went from a very small trading post kind of a community of maybe 600 people, the census not including Native Americans, just the Spanish residents, to a community of something like 25 or 30,000 people in 5 years.
Mm.
90% or more of those 25 or 30,000 people were men. That was true pretty much of the whole state. Most of those men were in their teens or 20s or 30s, some in their 40s, because they came out to go mining for gold, and that's hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Need to be reasonably vigorous. So we're talking about men in their physical and their sexual crimes. Now, I would not say that everybody who came here abandoned the beliefs they grew up with and the morality that they were taught and followed in the communities which they came from, many of which were very small communities. A great number of the people who came here had probably never been more than 25 miles from their homes. So I can't say that they all abandoned their moral codes. The other side of that, I can't imagine that 25 or 30,000 men in their physical and sexual primes abstained from all sexuality for 2 or 3 or 5 years, either in San Francisco or up in the gold camps. You know, we're talking about something like, you know, in excess of 100,000 people that came through San Francisco on their way up or on their way back. That seems just incredible to
mm-hmm,
me.
Mm-hmm.
So there must have been some people who, in the dark of night, in their cabin or their tent, may have reached under the covers towards, you know, the person next to them. Also, at that time, sexuality was not an identifying characteristic. A man that would have sex with another man was not somebody that we would consider to be gay. It was something somebody did, not who they were.
Yeah.
So that was a difference. Also, you had kind of a rowdy group of people. Some of them came out here to get away from home. Some of them came out here, of course, for a new start. Some of them left families with the expectation, at least of the family, that they would go back, and they never did.
Mm-hmm.
They simply vanished from the family. The gold rush left San Francisco with a couple of qualities that are still with us. One is that from the first day that the first Argonaut landed here, there was a housing shortage.
Mm.
We still have the housing shortage.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not unusual for adult single men to live together. Now, I would not say, and I can't believe that it's true, that all the adult men that were living together became intimate with each other, but it certainly provided a way for them to be intimate with each other and create relationships between each other that would not otherwise have been noticed. Nobody would have considered it. Well, you have to live someplace, and so the two men are living together. Mm-hmm. Nobody would have made any sense, you know, or seen anything in that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something that happens. We do know that there is at least a subculture here, because in the 1860s, or beginning in the 1860s, there is an author here named Charles Warren Stoddard, who was known as the boy poet of San Francisco. He's in his teens, in his 20s. We would call him the Lavender Boy Poet of San Francisco. He is known today mostly for writing stories about his travels in the South Pacific, Hawaii, and Tahiti, and some of the other islands, which are very much in the tradition of the books that Melville wrote about his journeys in the South Pacific. Melville is a little bit more frank about the same-sex relationships among the sailors on these ships. But those relationships were notorious. Melville called, you know, the ship that he was on a wooden-walled Gomorrah of the seas, or something to that effect, because you've got all these men on the ship for 3 years, or something like that. And there was even slang for sexual intimacy on the ship. And Stoddard is writing about that. He's writing about his experiences with other men on the ship and their experiences with each other and his experiences with young men that he's meeting, because he's also a young man, that he's meeting in Hawaii and he's meeting in Tahiti. And there is nothing explicit or graphic about this, but it's very present. He's talking about, this watching the stars at night from the veranda of the house they're staying with and becoming tired and, you know, going to bed. And, you know, his companion puts his arm around him and so to sleep. And you just say, you want to turn the page and let's get into it. And he ends, because he couldn't publish it.
That's exactly it, right? I mean, you couldn't at that time write about homosexuality or two male relationships.
You could not, but you could allude to it. Mm-hmm. So there is always some conversation about, you know, what the intention is of the author. Hubert Howe Bancroft, who was a local historian at actually a history factory, writes this, you know, multi-volume history of California, and he's talking about the bonds between the miners, because the weaker miners would be helped by the stronger miners. Not everybody could survive that particularly rugged life. And he's talking about, and they created bonds like in the days of Damien and Pythias. Mm-hmm. Well, people now may not know their Greek history, but the people that were reading Bancroft did. And they would have known that Damien and Pythias were a gay couple. So you're saying, well, is he just talking about a very close friendship, or is he really saying some of these guys had intimacy in all ways, that they were close in all ways? And we could speculate on that. Mm-hmm. It's clearer with Stoddard because he's describing the men that he's meeting and how they're expressing their affection, not their physical intimacy, but their affection for each other in a way that is very, very obvious. I mean, it's very clear. People at the time didn't necessarily notice this. William Dean Howells, who's a friend of Stoddard's, reviews these stories and just thinks they're these light, frothy, wonderful accounts of, you know, foreign lands and his travels. And there's no mention of this. Stoddard goes on to write a series of articles for the San Francisco Chronicle from his travels in Europe, and he's describing the swarthy gondola builders that he can see from his window. Well, somebody that was straight wouldn't necessarily be describing, you know, the sweaty, muscular gondola builders. We know a lot about Stoddard because he was probably the most open LGBT person in San Francisco. I mean, he didn't discuss it openly. You wouldn't have called him that, but everybody knew his story. And as far as we can tell, most people didn't care. As long as you weren't doing it in public, they didn't care. The people at the Chronicle, of course, knew his story, and they're writing about him. And he sounds like a real queen, as we would interpret it. I mean, they're describing him being effeminate and fainting away on the deck of the ship as he leaves with his friends. Stoddard also is writing about this because he's talking about at one time he is leaving to go to, I think, to Hawaii, and he's walking along the Embarcadero, which even in the 1860s and 70s was reasonably notorious if you knew people who knew people. And he's talking about, out of the darkness, hearing sounds one would not expect to hear, along the Embarcadero. Well, we know what he's talking about. Although most of his readers probably didn't. He also knows all the other people that are here. He has what we might call a community, but it's probably more accurate to say it was a circle of friends. But he meets even Plimpton, who's an actor. They have a rather torrid affair, according to Stoddard, which was too intense to last. So they have an affair. He also knows, and Plimpton goes on to become a leading juvenile and then a leading man on Broadway in the 1880s, 1890s, and stars with Modjeska and some of the great leading ladies of the period. And they remain friends, and in later life, Plimpton has this summer home that Stoddard goes to, and Plimpton's invited all the charming young men in Massachusetts to the home. It's sort of like a gay resort almost. He also knows Theodore Dwight, who later becomes head of the Boston Public Library. And they discover he's working here at the telegraph office, but they discover that they have a number of things in common. Including they like collecting autographs, which was popular at the time, and they like photographs of naked men. And in later years, several decades later, Dwight, who's becomes part of the diplomatic service, is coming back from Italy and writes Stoddard saying, "You won't believe what I was able to get through customs." And they see some of the pictures, and he's talking about pictures he's gotten from von Gladden and some of the other artistic photographers of male nudes. But being Theodore Dwight, he's able to convince them that these are art studies, and he's bringing them in, for the library and for the people, for the collections. He says, "And you won't believe what I was able to get through customs for you, and you'll see them the next time we get together." So these people know each other. Stoddard becomes Mark Twain's secretary for a while when Stoddard is in Europe. Twain is in England. Twain knows all about Stoddard. He writes to somebody else that he thinks Stoddard is such a nice little girl. Such a nice girl. Well, Twain knows what's going on. He doesn't care. Stoddard's standing on his side of the room, and Twain is on his side of the room, and they both love to talk, and they got along fine. Nobody cared. If it had been come public, if he had been labeled publicly, specifically, there might have been some issue, but they allude to it. People, in his circles, which we might call bohemian circles, we're very open to it.
Yeah. But even at that time, isn't it true that this wasn't just a social risk? There was also a risk of being arrested. I mean, it was a crime to engage in sex with someone of the same gender, right?
Only sodomy is illegal. That's in the state constitution, which is passed in 1849, which actually the meetings to write the constitution were attended by a journalist who came out here to look at the gold rush, Bayard Taylor, who Stoddard knows, who we are not sure what his sexuality was, because in those days, which is probably true today as well, a lot of people who liked men got married and had children. Taylor was one of them, but he's also writing basically erotic poetry about Arab men that he's meeting in the Middle East. Mm. But it's just him describing, how exotic other cultures are. It's, he's no love interest, right? Stoddard thinks that Taylor is unhappy because we can't, follow his nature, as he would put it. They know each other. They know who each other is. People may not have talked about any of this at dinner, but because sodomy was illegal, although the state constitution may not have been valid, because it was passed in 1849 for the state of California, and California didn't become a state until 1850. Hmm. So it may not have been valid, but nobody ever said anything. And it was sodomy was against the law since the days of the Spanish invasion. So this was just a continuation of sure. that. Nothing else was. Nothing between women was illegal, because women were not considered to be sexual. So why and how would they have sex together?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Another concept that has changed over time. But the papers were not reluctant to publish news about people being arrested and convicted of sodomy specifically. So this is not unknown. I mean, it's considered to be an aberration. They're always quick to point out that the person was an evil looking person or a foreigner or somebody of low temperament, as they would say, but they're publishing these records. I mean, mm-hmm. this becomes public information, so people are aware of it, and it's also something that is coming from someplace else, and we can talk about that later, especially when we get up into some of the newer things, because that's something that persists very much across time.
Yeah. Well, of course, and the publishing of those records continued well on into the 20th century. That was a tactic that police used to expose, if you will, or humiliate the people that they arrested for a variety of morals charges in gay bars and so forth. My guest tonight is Dr. William Lipsky, and we're discussing his newest book, LGBTQ+ Trailblazers of San Francisco. We're going to take a quick music break, so stay with us. There's a lot more to come.
I'm not afraid to
And that was Adam Lambert's rendition of Cher's Believe. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB-FM. I'm Greg Moralia, and tonight my guest is Dr. William Lipsky. We're talking about his recent book, LGBTQ Plus Trailblazers of San Francisco. So my sense is from reading what you've found and researched is that being gay or lesbian was kind of an unspoken thing up until about 1920. And I actually think you called that year out in the book. But I want you to talk about the Baker Street scandal. When we first talked about the book, you said that was one of the things that fascinated you most. And that also seemed to be sort of a turning point from when law enforcement and the government sort of just ignored this to actually hunting down gay people and being more aggressive about it. Did I characterize that right?
Absolutely right. And until the 1920s, law enforcement was reactive, not proactive in terms of gay people, who we would call gay people. They didn't call themselves that. They would have called themselves temperamentals. And we can talk about that because that goes all the way back into the 1860s. And in the 20s, people were just beginning to talk about them as terms of homosexuals. And they're not quite settled on all of this because they're also calling them homosexualists. And that comes up in the Baker Street thing. But until the 20s in San Francisco, the police don't do anything about same-sex intimacy unless somebody reports it. And that change comes about, I think, partly from Baker Street and partly from just changing social concepts. Before Baker Street, the United States Army was conducting military operations on the border with Mexico. And the military presence there was a huge scandal because of the camp followers and the laxity that the military showed to the camp followers. So they basically did nothing about the liquor sales, the gambling, the prostitution, and all the other things that became available. I mean, this has gone on, you know, for a long time. You know, we know in the Civil War, the name hooker for a prostitute comes from one of the Civil War generals because among the camp followers were a large number of prostitutes. In following Hooker's Army, which is also became a slang term for that. So when the United States entered World War I, President Woodrow Wilson issued a pledge to the mothers of America because of the scandals in 1912, 1913, that their sons would be returned to them with the same high moral standards or higher moral standards as when they left. So the military made a very concerted effort when the United States entered the war in 1917 to ensure the morality of the troops. In fact, they passed an ordinance that forbade the sale of liquor to anybody in the military within 5 miles of a base in San Francisco. Well, San Francisco is only 7 miles apart across, so basically they made San Francisco drive for the military. And it was illegal for anybody to give directions to somebody in the military as to where was the nearest house of prostitution. So they were very much an attempt to maintain the morals. One of the things they feared particularly was the influence of the city, the civilians on the military. And this becomes And you find throughout all of this, homosexuality is a corruption that comes from a foreign influence. And you're going to get that all the way up into the 50s. We can talk about that too. So they didn't want the civilians fooling around with the soldiers and corrupting them and depleting them of their vital bodily fluids, and weakening their morale and the morality and their strength by having sex with other men. The military had had an experience with that here in the Spanish-American War, because this was one of the points of departure to go to the Philippines in 1898. And there were so many soldiers working the east wall of the Presidio that they brought the price down for, you know, intimacy to virtually nothing, which is fascinating that these, you know, straight soldiers supposedly, they didn't have a problem with that. You know, gay for pay is what I think what we would call it today. Again, because it didn't define them as a person, it was just something they were doing. But it also shows that there was a network here, because the people that went out to the Presidio, they could go out there and meet somebody. Same thing happens with Baker Street. So the military discovers 1917 that not only are there civilians that are meeting and having sex with the soldiers, it's basically a block and a half from the Presidio. So they contact San Francisco Police Department and raid the house on Baker Street. It's two flats, it's a duplex. And they really don't have the authority to do this, so it's under, you know, the authority of the local police, which does have the authority. The military has no policing authority off base with policing civilians. So they have to go in with the police authority, and they get it. They commandeer the house. They keep it for 10 days, which is certainly not legal, because they're just marching. And they start interviewing. The military is interviewing soldiers that they can identify and civilians that they find out about their activities with each other. And eventually there's something like, you know, 50 names that come up. And it's the old thing of, well, who did, you know, did you meet? And who else have you heard about? And then bring that, the person they named or the people they named in, and, you know, going, you know, getting more names. And the soldiers cooperate with no attorneys. There's no attorneys present. There's no Miranda rights yet. Nobody's talking about any of that. It seems that the soldiers are cooperating because this is higher authority. These are people, you know, these are officers that they're talking to. And the civilians cooperate, and they do, because they think they're helping the military in a time of war with an investigation. And while the military makes sure that the people talking to them understand that they are doing it, they're giving information under their own free will, they don't understand, one, that, because they're never told, they don't have to cooperate. And they don't understand that if they cooperate, this information can be used for more than an investigation. This can be charges against them. So they interview, a dozen or more people at Baker Street. And they, you know, arrest the soldiers pending court-martial. They go off to Alcatraz, where they're held, because it's still an army prison then. And they take the civilians to jail, to San Francisco jail. It results in the court martial and the conviction of six of the soldiers, and the conviction of two of the civilians. Four of the soldiers go up to McNeil. They get, you know, terms of 4 or 5 to 10 years at McNeil. One of them is imprisoned at Alcatraz. He's actually the youngest one. He's married. He wasn't at the time of Baker Street. He's gotten married since. And he is ill. It sounds like he was tubercular, but I can't get the records. So they let him off with time served. The two civilians get, you know, 5 to indefinite, and they go to San Quentin.
Hmm. So by today's terms, I mean, this is really crazy to think about, getting 5 to 10 years for engaging in consensual sex with someone of the same gender. But I think what's also interesting about this is the tactics used here around interrogating the military officers, asking them for other people that they were associated with. That's really 20 years before all of what happened in the Lavender Scare, when the FBI did exactly the same thing and used much of the same tactics for hunting people who are gay or lesbian working in the federal government, and then also what military authorities did in those years as well. But in this case, there was a flaw in California law, wasn't there? And that ended up getting everybody sort of released. What happened?
Just before Baker Street, the state legislature passes a law forbidding oral sex. And for the first time, it includes women. So all oral sex is forbidden between men and women, between two men, between two women. This is the first time that anything other than sodomy has been made illegal as an intimacy, and the first time women have been included in it. Nobody knows what they're talking about, including the courts. The first court case is for a man having fellatio with a woman, which is not possible. But nobody knows what this is. So a lot of the people in Baker Street are charged with having oral sex, but while the trials are in process, the law is challenged all the way up to the state Supreme Court. Because as you know, laws in the state of California have to be written in English.
Right.
And the argument is that the language of this law is not English. Fellatio is not an English word, so it's unconstitutional. And amazingly, the court agrees, and they throw out the law. So all the oral sex charges are dropped. So nobody goes to prison for that. Now the legislature puts it back and makes it very clear in English, and that law is on the books till the 1970s.
Again, really crazy to think about the idea that two consenting adults, including opposite sex couples, could be put in prison for having consensual oral sex. Well, you know, we've just barely scratched the surface of the stories and the people you include in this book, LGBTQ+ Trailblazers of San Francisco. I mean, who knew the first gay rights protest actually happened at Vacaville State Prison back in 1956? You have a story about that in the book. It's really great, and it's a perfect summer read. We've been talking with Dr. William Lipsky, author of LGBTQ+ Trailblazers of San Francisco. Bill, thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight.
Thank you for having me on.
And you can find Dr. Lipsky's book, LGBTQ+ Trailblazers of San Francisco, available at the GLBT Museum on 18th Street, just up from Castro in San Francisco, or from any online bookseller. We'll put a link to the book on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click on show notes at the top of the page. And that wraps up our hour. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Grayer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.